Hello everybody and welcome back to the Damage Report with what's left of me, John Iadarola. I'm gonna fall apart over the course of this week, but thank you for sticking with me as my throat gets rockier and rockier. We've got a great show planned for you today. I'm gonna be running through some of the updated messaging around this impending conflict with Iran from Mike Pompeo. But just shortly after that, I'll be joined by Jordan Ewell once again. We're gonna be walking through some of the big news of the day, including the cheerleading for war crimes on Fox News and what's looking like what's gonna be a new phase in the Democratic primary. One marked by more direct conflict between Joe Biden and some of the candidates who have been a little bit hesitant to directly criticize him. There is evidence today that is falling away as we get closer to the Iowa caucuses in less than 1 month. After that, Alex Ward of Vox is gonna be joining the show to break down exactly what a war between the US and Iran might actually look like. How bad would it be? How many lives and how much money could it possibly cost? And then we're gonna be closing out the show with another look at what's going on in Australia. We've got some new figures showing how devastating the fires have actually been. Far worse than previously reported even on this show, and we've been watching it since the beginning. But before all of that, let's start off in Washington. Mike Pompeo is having a tough job of it the past couple of days, attempting to square his past statements about the conflict between the US and Iran with Donald Trump's increasingly belligerent rhetoric. Now, I wanna show you some of the ways he's been changing his messaging. The first has to do with how exactly the decision was made to do the strike of last Thursday night. So here is what Mike Pompeo recently said.
Anytime a president makes a decision of this magnitude, there are multiple pieces of information that come before us. We presented that to him in all its broad detail. We gave him all the best information that came not only from the intelligence community, but for those of us who have teams in the field. We evaluated the relevant risks and the opportunity that we thought might present itself at some point, and we could see clearly.
So there you see Mike Pompeo saying that what effectively happened was all of the, you know, the top intelligence representatives of the intelligence agencies, all the people in the know, either because they have direct access to intelligence having to do with Iraq, Iran, regional conflict, or those with their own networks in the area, and he lumped himself into that group. They coordinated with the president and they made the decision that they had to make. He said that. But we already knew when he said that, that was not at all how this decision was actually made. Take a look at an excerpt from New York Times reporting from over the weekend that said, in the chaotic days leading to the death of Major General Qasem Soleimani, Iran's most powerful commander, top American military officials put the option of killing him, which they viewed as the most extreme response to recent Iranian-led violence in Iraq, on the menu they presented to President Trump. They didn't think he would take it. And the wars waged since the September 11, 2001 attacks, Pentagon officials have often offered improbable options to presidents to make other possibilities appear more palatable. By late Thursday, the president had gone for the extreme option. Top Pentagon officials were stunned. They weren't stunned because they all came to the president and said, this is what has to be done to save American lives, and he decided to do it. They were stunned because no one expected him to actually take that option. But because it's the president, because that's what he did, they all now need to do two things. One, anonymously contact the New York Times to complain about what happened, and then go and do their press conferences, like you just saw with Mike Pompeo, where they implied that what Trump did was perfectly rational and everybody believed that it needed to be done. Behind closed doors, that's not what they're saying. Maybe Pompeo thinks that, Trump certainly does. I'm sure they can get John Bolton on their side, but that's not at all how this was actually done. And to give you an idea of how much backtracking is actually going on, I want you to think back over the past few days. They said we had intelligence showing that Soleimani was imminently going to present some sort of threat. He was going to attack American civilians or soldiers in some fashion. And they have repeatedly refused to offer any specificity whatsoever in the days since the strike. Well, if you were hoping, maybe if we just wait, we'll eventually get some info. I got a video clip for you that should give you a reason to doubt that. Let's take a look.
At the end of last year in December, ultimately leading to the death of an American. So if you're looking for imminence, you need to look no further than the days that led up to the strike that was taken against Soleimani. And then you, in addition to that, have what we could clearly see were continuing efforts on behalf of this terrorist to build out a network of campaign activities that were gonna lead potentially to the death of many more Americans.
So at the end there, you had the same sort of vague language that we've gotten over the past week. There were some things that made us think that maybe something would happen to some people somewhere. That's as specific as they've been willing to be. They've now had days to sort of huddle together, get their stories straight, and they've come back with the exact same sort of vague BS that's convincing no one that didn't already want a war with Iran. But I'm far more interested in the beginning of that clip where he said, oh, if you want specifics, take a look at the thing that he'd already done. But that's not at all what you or Trump said about what led you to believe that he had to be killed last Thursday evening. You said he was about to do something. Now you're talking about, oh, he did something before. There's your imminence. No, there's your past. It can't be imminent if it already happened. And so that is a major retreat. And again, I get that laws don't mean anything in America, but one of the reasons that we cared about the pretext for killing Soleimani was not just because we want to understand, it's because he can't legally start a conflict like this unless there's a reason. And they are continuing to show that there was no reason. It was just a choice that he made, one that stunned top Pentagon officials. And so they're effectively admitting every single day with press conferences like this and appearances in the media that, yeah, Donald Trump broke the law and he doesn't care because there's not going to be any consequences. And in that, I actually agree with them. I don't think that there will be. But now let's catch up to one of the most ridiculous things that Mike Pompeo has been wrapped up in. And that was Donald Trump tweeted over the weekend, I'm going to take out their cultural sites. I don't care if you think it's a war crime, I'm going to do it. He then went on the news and said, oh, he didn't say that. And then Trump doubled down saying, no, we're going to take out their cultural sites. And now take a look. He's being asked even tougher questions because of the way this has been going. Here's how he responds to it.
The president said on Air Force One coming back after you had been on the Sunday talk shows that they're allowed to kill our people. They're allowed to torture and maim our people. They're allowed to use roadside bombs and blow up our people. And we're not allowed to touch their cultural sites. It doesn't work that way. Defense Secretary Esper has made it clear that he would not follow an order to hit a cultural site, which would be a war crime. I'm wondering whether you would also push back in your advice or in your role.
You're not really wondering, Andrea. You're not really wondering. I was unambiguous on Sunday. It is completely consistent with what the president has said.
We will take
every action we take will be consistent with the international rule of law, and the American people can rest assured that that's the case. Let me tell you who's done damage to the Persian culture. It's not the United States of America. It's the Ayatollah. The real risk to Persian culture does not come from the United States of America. There is no mistake about that. Thank you all. Everybody have a good day.
Okay, that sort of exit has never been taken by a person that just adequately responded to concerns expressed by a reporter, in this case, Andrew Mitchell. No, he did his little smile and he walked away as people yelled at him because he knew that what he had spread was a combination of BS and what they believe was a clever change to the narrative. Well, you know who's really done damage to the Iranian culture? That would be, and then he goes off on his thing. No, Trump just said he's going to bomb sites of cultural significance. And earlier on, he'd said, what I said was, I was unambiguous and I was consistent. No, you said he didn't say that he was going to do that when he had already said it, and he said it after you said it. There was nothing unambiguous about that, except Donald Trump's hard-on for bombing sites that are important to Iranian culture. That's all. He wants to pretend that they've been consistent. They haven't been. He's not even consistent with the other person that was referenced in that question, which was the acting Secretary of Defense. And to give you the specifics of what he said, Mr. Esper said, we will follow the laws of armed conflict when asked if cultural sites would be targeted, as the president had suggested over the weekend. When a reporter asked if that meant no, because the laws of war prohibited targeting cultural sites, Mr. Esper agreed, quote, that's the laws of armed conflict. So Mr. Esper is not in agreement with Trump. And Mike Pompeo was not in agreement with the acting Secretary of Defense either. Trump said he would bomb these sites. There has been cheerleading for it, as we're going to show you on Fox News. Pompeo needs to come out and be actually unambiguous for once. Do you support Donald Trump's threat, his promise to commit war crimes, or do you not? Mark Esper is now on the record. I would love to see Pompeo join him there. Okay, we're going to take a short break. We come back, Jordan Ewell is going to join us after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called Un*** the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of On the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Ever since Donald Trump promised to bomb sites of cultural significance to Iran, you've had two groups of his defenders. You have those in the administration pretending that he didn't say that, as he says it over and over again. And then you have Fox News, where they could not be more delighted. Here is Pete Hegseth.
Pete, when you hear the Democrats saying, wait, why did he do this now? Is this related to impeachment? What do you think?
I think with friends like these Democrats, who needs the Iranians? I mean, ultimately, this is the resistance continuing overseas as adamantly as we've seen it here at home. Listen, you may not like President Trump. You may have voted for the impeachment in the House. But if you're someone like Comrade Cortez, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, tweeting, saying that a tweet from the president threatening the Iranians is in and of itself a war crime, you've lost your mind.
Wait a second. That was related to destroy the cultural
52 sites, one of which might be cultural. Actually, by the way, I don't care about Iranian cultural sites, and I'll tell you why. If they could, if Iran could, if you understand the Islamic Republic of Iran, of Islamists, if they could, if they had the power, they would destroy every single one of our cultural sites and build a mosque on top of it. If you don't understand the nature of our enemy, you're foolish about who you're pointing out and whether or not you're happy that Soleimani is dead. This guy has exported terrorism for that regime for 40 years, and the fact that Democrats in this country can't take a pause to say, this is a good thing, now let's figure out how to prevent an Iranian bomb, they just go straight to politics, and it's shameful.
Joining us now to break down this and other big news of the day, Jordan Ewell, welcome back to the Damage Report.
John, thank you for having me.
Glad to have you on. So there you saw Pete Hegseth, and there were a few different things that I take issue with in that. But the biggest point is that he sort of said something similar to what Trump said, where Trump was like, oh, they get to do this and they get to do that, and we don't get to bomb their cultural sites, as if they've been wanting it for so long. They don't understand why there should be a prohibition. Pete Hegseth says, oh, they would do it to us, so why shouldn't we be able to? What do you think about that sort of philosophy?
Well, I mean, first and foremost, like deliberately targeting a cultural site or a cultural heritage site with no military value is like a violation of international law and a war crime by definition. So it's important to establish that at the onset. But this just shows this kind of callous disregard for people in other countries and this militaristic, this jingoistic worldview that embodies, that many of the Fox hosts and many Republican pundits and figures embody. They see Iranians in general, I mean, he wasn't distinguishing between military people or just the layperson in general. He was just summarily writing off all Muslims in Iran as people who don't care about our culture or our cultural sites, or people who, you know, it was kind of this victim blaming mindset. So it's important to understand that that is what shapes this jingoistic foreign policy. It's this view that people on the other side of conflict are subhuman.
Mm-hmm. And you know, there's a few other things I want to talk about in that. But one thing I noticed was, and I believe Edwin in studio noticed it too. All of a sudden, they physically can't say Iran. They have to say the Islamic Republic of Iran. And then he repeated and said Islamists. And so when I tweeted yesterday that there was this like 24/7 bloodthirsty Islamophobia, that's sort of what I'm referring to there. It's not just that they have a problem with Iran, that Iran is an enemy of ours. It's that they are gleeful that they get to talk about how bad Islam is and how Islam is our enemy. And they are like, Bush got in trouble for pitching the war in Iraq as a crusade. They are out and out branding this as a new crusade. What do you think about that?
I mean, this is quintessential Christian fascism. This is what you remark about the Crusades. Like, this is just a long-standing conflict, and this jingoism, this xenophobia, this Islamophobia infects right-wing politics and, to an extent, some left-leaning politics as well in the United States. It's easy for them to then write off deaths overseas. It's easy for them to justify military conflict because then it's not just a conflict between two nations. It's then furthering their religion. It's furthering their worldview, and they see Islam and Muslims as inherently evil. And just, you know, so again, to go back to what I just said, it's this view where they see people on the other side of conflict as subhuman.
You know, and I believe that I saw that you tweeted about this in the past day, and that was that, you know, it wasn't just by chance. It's Pete Hegseth there talking about how he thinks that we should be committing these war crimes. He's popped up on this topic in regards to Trump before, correct?
Right. Pete Hegseth, loves defending war crimes and war criminals. Eddie Gallagher, the Navy SEAL who killed a young girl in Iraq, who faced a military tribunal for killing an enemy combatant that they had captured. This combatant was receiving medical attention. Eddie Gallagher, it was a grisly murder. He used his knife to just cut this guy's throat. This guy is psychotic, and was standing trial for war crimes. And Eddie Gallagher was privately lobbying Trump to pardon him. Pete Hegseth was privately lobbying Trump to pardon Eddie Gallagher. And this is something that Hegseth has defended multiple times, openly advocated for pardoning war criminals in the past. It's not new. And of course, of anyone on Fox, it's this guy.
I want to turn to another aspect of the media run-up in this conflict, and that is that we've had a few days now since the strike against Soleimani, mainstream media shows have been filled by people, both on the shows, writing op-eds, people who have a vested interest in how this conflict is going to go, and it has not been identified when they appear in the media in that way. I want to give credit to Li Feng at The Intercept, who did a great write-up of some of the examples of this. I want to point out a few. That is, we had a Jack Keane, retired Army general, appeared on Fox News and NPR over the last 3 days to praise Trump for the strike. He's worked for military companies, including General Dynamics and Blackwater, and currently serves as a partner at SCP Partners, a venture capital firm that invests in defense contractors. You had Van Hipp, chair of the lobbying firm American Defense International, which represents more than 24 defense contractors, including the manufacturer of the drone that was used in the strike. That he published an opinion column on Fox News' website praising Trump and suggesting increased pressure on the Iranian government, which would, of course, benefit the companies that he represents. You also had David Petraeus, John Negroponte, Jay Johnson. All of these are people who have appeared to either congratulate Donald Trump or push for further conflict. And they have not been identified in any of those cases as people that represent companies who stand to make millions or billions of dollars off of a conflict. And I know that you've done quite a bit of media criticism in the past. What do you think about the media being so willing to sort of whitewash these people's conflicts of interest?
I mean, this is a classic case of manufacturing consent and the media's role in banging the war drum. Yet at the end of the day, you have to remember that media companies, for the most part, are for-profit enterprises. And war often boosts ratings, it sells papers. And very seldom do you see outlets like TYT who's willing always to hold people in power to account. But the vast majority of outlets are out there, you know, providing platforms to people who were architects of the Iraq War, or like you just pointed out, have a financial interest in us going to war with Iran. This is just the power and the influence of the military-industrial complex.
Yeah. Okay, we do have to take a quick break, Jordan, but if you can stick around, we got a couple more topics I want to hit on with you after this. In this Democratic primary, Joe Biden, the front runner, one of what was perceived to be his biggest weaknesses going into this was his support for the war in Iraq. That has so far not been used against him very effectively through the course of this primary, but we might be entering into a period where that will change. And joining us now to comment, Jordan, welcome back to the Damage Report.
John, thank you for having me.
Glad to have you here. So we got a new video that I saw on The Intercept that is pretty powerful in rebutting what has happened over the past week, which is Joe Biden saying or attempting to spin his support for the war in Iraq as sort of a begrudging acceptance that military conflict might be necessary, but he never thought they had weapons of mass destruction. And as soon as we were in there, he was against it. So that's what Joe Biden has said. But I want to take everyone back to 1998 to something else that he said. So for context, in 1998, UN Weapons Inspector Scott Ritter resigned in protest and accused the international community of not giving him and his colleagues the support they needed to carry out their job in Iraq, which had agreed in 1991 to destroy its chemical weapons stockpile. So Scott Ritter goes before the Senate, and here is what Joe Biden said at the time.
I think you and I believe, and many of us believe here, as long as Saddam's at the helm, there is no reasonable prospect. You or any other inspector is ever going to be able to guarantee that we have rooted out, root and branch, the entirety of Saddam's program relative to weapons of mass destruction. And you and I both know, and all of us here really know, and it's the thing we have to face, that the only way we're going to get rid of Saddam Hussein is we're going to end up having to start it alone, and it's going to require guys like you in uniform to be back on foot in the desert taking taking Saddam down. You know it, and I know it.
So that message was delivered almost as if it was a joke. He thought he'd hit multiple punchlines there, but that's a good half decade before we invade Iraq. He's making the case that there is no way without an invasion and taking Saddam out, that no matter how many weapons inspectors you have on the ground, you will never be able to guarantee that he doesn't have weapons of mass destruction, which does not seem to square with what he's been saying recently about his record on this topic.
Right. I mean, recently he's been saying that he opposed the Iraq war since the very moment it began. He's been saying this at town halls, he's been saying this at campaign events. And reporters have called this out because it's objectively false. Like, you could just look at his record and see that and even before the 2003 invasion, he was supporting some intervention and possibly regime change in Iraq. So Biden is just trying to distance himself from his record because, you know, this is a weak spot. He's desperate. You're seeing the surge of Sanders in polls nationwide. You know, Sanders is right on his heels. So he's trying to distract people from that, including lying about it. Because he can't answer for it. He also can't answer for the hundreds of thousands of people, including many of them innocent people, who died as a result of his and many other senators' votes. And he was part of that effort. So naturally, you understand why he wants to get away from it, but he can't. This is part of his record.
You know what's interesting? It's like the 100th most important side effect of what's happening with Iran right now. But still, when it comes to the Democratic primary, as I alluded to in the intro, Joe Biden's support for the war hasn't really seemed to hurt him very much. And it seemed to imply to me that the American people, the primary electorate, weren't really thinking about issues of war very much when deciding who they would support. And so I'm curious, with what looks like the possibility of a war on the horizon, do you think that that might have some effect on candidates like Joe Biden, that it might make his past record on this sort of issue more salient for primary voters?
I'm curious, honestly, what people will think about the, I mean, most people have come to acknowledge that the Iraq war was a complete and total failure. Most people accept that, you know, it should have never happened. Some also agree the same on Afghanistan. I don't know what kind of mover it'll be in voting, because a lot of people in America just like are you know, they'll go along with whatever the party establishment says. And to for a general like wave in the Democratic Party to acknowledge that the Iraq War was a mistake would also condemn a lot of other top Democrats. So I'm curious how that'll play out. I think it's smart of Bernie to be loud and vocal in pointing out those differences between his vote and Biden's vote and people who supported the war. But we'll see. I just think there's a lot of people who buy the military propaganda, and the media has a large role in that. I think it's on outlets like CNN and MSNBC, although I don't have faith in them, but it's on them to point out that this war was an absolute catastrophe. They played a role in championing that.
Yeah. Let's turn to another aspect of this. As I alluded to in the intro, Bernie Sanders is now seemingly more willing to be critical of Joe Biden on issues of war and other topics. We saw a little bit of that at the last debate. We've got a new video I'm going to go to in just a second where he's not just more willing to criticize Joe Biden, but to really drive home the long list of issues, things that haven't yet seemed to hurt Joe Biden too much in this primary, but that he seems to be more willing to bring up. And we might see that in the run-up to Iowa. So here is Bernie Sanders recently on Joe Biden's record.
Joe and I are friends, and I truly like Joe. But what is imperative is that we defeat Trump, the most dangerous president in modern history. And that means you're going to have a huge voter turnout. You're going to have to get working people excited. You're going to have to get young people excited. Joe Biden voted and helped lead the effort for the war in Iraq, the most dangerous foreign policy blunder in the modern history of this country. Joe Biden voted for the disastrous trade agreements like NAFTA and permanent normal trade relations with China, which cost us millions of jobs. You think that's going to play well in Michigan or Wisconsin or Pennsylvania? You know, Joe Biden has been on the floor of the Senate talking about the need to cut Social Security or Medicare or Medicaid. Joe Biden pushed a bankruptcy bill, which has caused enormous financial problems for working families. So if we're going to beat Trump, we need turnout. And to get turnout, you need energy and excitement. And I just don't think that that kind of record is going to bring forth the energy that we need to defeat Trump.
So let's talk now about Joe Biden, because we have this interesting thing where I agree with Senator Sanders that Biden does not have big turnout at his events. He doesn't have seemingly much enthusiasm from his core supporters, and yet he has maintained first in the polls for something like 9 months now. So he doesn't have the enthusiasm, but he does apparently have durability that I did not predict last year. And so like we're on the precipice of launching into caucuses and primaries. If you were advising Bernie Sanders, Jordan, what would you tell him is necessary to start to finally crack into that first place standing of Joe Biden?
If I was advising Bernie Sanders, and not that he is doing anything outside of this, but like really hammer home establishment Democrats' votes on trade deals, especially in the Rust Belt, and how it just decimated the Rust Belt. NAFTA is a household term in the Rust Belt because workers across that region understand that that was one of the reasons that many of them lost their jobs, many of them had a shift eliminated, many of them saw reductions in hours. Biden is not your friend. Biden is a corporate Democrat and has been for years. Delaware is, you know, a safe haven for corporations, and he's represented corporate interests his entire career. Why all of a sudden would you expect Biden to do a 180 as he tries to reach his ultimate goal, like the ultimate self-serving accomplishment of becoming president? Why all of a sudden would he do a 180 and finally start caring about you, especially as he's having high dollar fundraisers with corporate executives? He does not care about you. Biden does not care about workers.
Yeah, we unfortunately don't have time to go into the detail I wanted on this topic, but another big thing in the news today is Elizabeth Warren's new bankruptcy plan, which doesn't explicitly call out Joe Biden, but he was one of the big sponsors on the Democratic side of the 2005 bankruptcy reform bill that has done a lot of damage to working families. Do you think that that sort of thing might, like that you have the war and trade deals coming from Sanders, you have bankruptcy coming from Elizabeth Warren, is that the 1-2 punch that finally convinces people that Joe Biden might not be their guy?
I certainly hope so. I mean, because like that's just, you know, from top to bottom, Biden has sold out working class interests his entire career. He's been backed by corporations his entire career. He does not care about workers. He's made the like with the bankruptcy bill, he's made it harder for people to alleviate financial stress and you know, find some solace or a way out of bankruptcy or debt. He's represented big banks. He's represented special interests. The more that they can hammer him on those issues, I hope the more it'll resonate with voters, and finally they'll start to turn and look and realize that there's a progressive champion who's been fighting for them the entire time that they could support.
Well, Jordan Yule, as always, we appreciate you joining us on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
We're gonna take a short break here. When we come back, Alex Ward of Vox is gonna be joining us to talk about what a conflict with Iran could actually look like after this. With things as tense as they are between the United States and Iran today, I wanted to know what would it actually look like if some form of military conflict actually broke out between the US and Iran. And joining us now to break down some of the possibilities, staff writer on national security for Vox, Alex Ward. Welcome to the Damage Report.
Happy to be here.
Glad to have you here. And I very much enjoyed your write-up about some of these issues on Vox. And so before we launch into what an all-out military conflict with Iran might look like, based on the research that you've done, the people that you've spoken with, how likely do you think it is at present today that an actual war will break out between these two countries?
The good news is that it's still very, very, very unlikely. Mm-hmm. And that's when we're talking about a full-scale war. If you're thinking about the US and Iran, like, you know, US troops going in and invading, that's very, very far off and very unlikely. That the Iran and the US could continue to make provocations and escalate, that is actually likely to continue. So you could imagine Iran attacking Americans and the US retaliates with a pretty big strike. And then it's up to both governments to figure out a way to step down from the escalation ladder. So I think if people are worried about future confrontations between Iran and the US, they should be. I think violence is likely. I don't know exactly what that may look like. I mean, there are some options we can talk about, some possibilities. But the full-scale war that everyone's worried about, the World War III narrative, I think is very hyperbolic.
Okay, so short of all-out war, short of, you know, the Abrams storming the border, what are some of the most likely forms that some sort of reaction from Iran could take?
So Iran will most likely go after American diplomats in the Middle East. Actually, one region that is very weak would be in West Africa, where we do not have a lot of embassy protection. And Iran has shown that it can hit us in that region and has a lot of proxies in that region. Their proxies will also likely go after some of our allies in the Middle East, Saudi Arabia, Israel, maybe even Jordan. And they will try to sow chaos and, let's not sugarcoat this, try to kill Americans in an effort to get the U.S. to stop its pressure campaign against the country that we've reimposed since we left the Iran nuclear deal.
So let's say that something like that happens. They attack an embassy in Africa, or they ambush and kill diplomats. That's the sort of thing that Trump has implied on Twitter recently, that he would respond with some sort of disproportionate attack. So from your point of view, let's say they proceeded the way that you think might happen. What would a sane president do in response to that? And also, what would our president do in response to that?
That's a bit hard to answer, because there's the logic here of an escalation ladder is if Iran responds, the US should respond as well. Now, in the logic of this administration, they're saying that, well, if whatever Iran does, we are going to go even more so. We're going to, you know, escalate quite highly as an effort to deter future action. Now, that, at least in the logic of escalation ladder, could make sense. Of course, depends on what the US is trying to accomplish. So if Iran attacks an embassy, wherever it may be, and the US starts attacking Iranian ships or even missile sites inside of Iran, now that's a whole different ballgame, because even though the killing of Soleimani is a big deal, it did happen in Iraq, and there is some sort of separation there. But actual American bombs dropping inside of Iran would be very hard for Tehran to ignore and not sort of respond in a big way. And so that's when the worry of a bigger U.S.-Iran war really starts. I think it's not until that moment that we can kind of relax. But it really depends on what Trump's advisors tell the president to do. The fact that he's already willing to kill top military leaders means that he's probably not so opposed to going after targets inside of Iran as he's already threatened to do.
So I want to talk about what we both appear to deem as an unlikely outcome is all out full scale war. But before we get into that, I just want to show people, we had our producer Dan put together a little mock-up of the scale of Iran in comparison to our own country, if we could go to that for 1 second. And to give people an idea, because I think a lot of people know very little about countries outside of the United States, and they might not know that Iran is a significant patch of geography there, far larger than Iraq, larger than Afghanistan. It's a big country, so we don't necessarily believe that an actual full-out war will happen. But if it did, the Iranian military, based on what you know, what might that conflict look like? How serious of a defense could they put up if America decided to invade?
Well, more so actually than the Iranian troops. Iranian geography would be a pretty big challenge for American troops. I mean, the country itself is kind of a fortress. There are mountains all over on the borders. There are marshes that, you know, really ruined the Iraqi army's advances in the past. And so just the logistics of getting into Iraq, getting a large scale troop presence inside of Iran, boggle the mind on their own. Now, if we do have American troops, you know, going into cities and trying to take out Iranian troops, the Iranian troops cannot do too much. I mean, they're a large military, but they're not completely capable. Their air force isn't so great. Their navy is usually really small boats. So there's not so much it could really do to thwart American aims. But you could see them revert to asymmetric tactics like we saw in Iraq, right? Urban warfare, picking off American troops where they can. They'll know the terrain. They will have some support within the country to fight off Americans. And so, and with a bigger land area and a population that could rally around the government, despite the fact that a lot of Iranians are not fans of the government. So the challenges are more than just what can the Iranian military do. There's just a lot of problems just for the American military to do what it wants to do before we even get to actual fighting with Iranian troops.
So I know that this next question is way off into speculation. It's impossible to say, and it depends on so many different things. But if our government was to pursue something like an invasion, in terms of the number of soldiers that would be needed to start that, let alone to finish it, the amount of money that would need to be spent, how would you compare that to the conflict that we are still engaged in Iraq?
It would be scores more. Current estimates would have probably more than 1 million U.S. troops that would be needed in order to, you know, go to Tehran, take out the government, and possibly try to rebuild a new one. At the height of the Iraq War, we were like in the upper 100,000. So this is roughly, you know, 10 times more. You're looking at trillions of dollars, of course, years of investment. And let's even say the United States is successful. Let's say the United States actually gets into Tehran, takes out the government, and tries to rebuild one. Well, it's going to face a lot of problems because there's going to certainly be pockets, vacuums throughout the country that terrorist groups, militia groups, even clerics will try to take over. You could see a civil war begin, which will make it harder for the U.S. to rebuild the country and may require us to stay there even longer. And so, and on top of that, you'll have a refugee crisis both internally and a lot of these, Iranians fleeing for their lives, heading likely westward or elsewhere to find safe refuge. And so, it's going to be like all of this would make it more complicated, would require the U.S. to stay in longer, spend more money, and so that's sort of the aftermath in a way could almost be worse than the war itself.
And it seems like if his military advisors were to come back and to give him some version of what you just said about the likely expense in terms of soldiers' lives and money, that does not seem like a very appealing prospect. Maybe this is going way further than he would ever go, but he has talked a lot about the use of nuclear weapons in the past. And unconfirmed reports have said that he's asked his advisors why they can't be used in military conflicts. He has pushed for the use of more usable tactical nuclear weapons. Do you think that there's a 0% chance that would be one of the avenues he would want to take in terms of retaliation? Or do you think that with Donald Trump, there is at least some chance he would consider deploying nuclear weapons?
I think it's zero or about as close to zero as it could be. He has shown he toggles between isolationism and interventionism, and his interventionism is the terms are used here sort of like small scale pinprick types of attacks. I mean, they're still attacks, but he prefers drones, he prefers airstrikes. He does not seem to have an appetite for America getting bogged down in nation building and a large scale conflict, and nuclear weapons use would certainly involve that. I mean, and on top of that, it would further isolate the United States, which I think he at least cares about his view in history and how the world sees him. And I'm sure he'll know that a nuclear attack, even a tactical nuke, would doom him in history, and tons of people inside the Pentagon would push against it. And I'm almost sure a lot of his top advisors would. So I think for Trump, I don't think he has any problems with airstrikes, drone strikes, maybe something a little bit beyond that. But that's about as far as I think he's willing to go, at least at this point in time. And of course, let's not forget, Iran has a vote in this too. You know, don't let Iran off the hook here. They don't have to respond aggressively. This is not a choice that they have to make. And so, you know, we also have to think about, well, what should the U.S. do as it needs to protect Americans around the world?
Okay. Alex Ward, national security writer for Vox. Thank you so much for joining us on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to take a short break here. When we come back, we're going to do a little bit of an update about what's going on in Australia right now. New numbers on the toll when it comes to animals that have been killed by these bushfires after this. The bushfires in Australia have now been burning for literally months, consuming an area that almost defies comparison. Every day, some new comparison is made. It's the size of the East Coast put together. It's Belgium. It's a lot of area. And every day, it seems to get worse. The health impact, even on people who've survived and flee to cities, is horrendous. It has killed at least 24 people, devastated an ever-increasing amount of property, and also has been devastating in a way that is difficult to quantify on animals as well. And that's where I just want to catch you up a little bit on how bad it has been. University of Sydney ecologist Chris Dickman said the number of animals killed in the blazes has topped 1 billion. I mean, you probably saw going around on social media, there were estimates of 450 million just a few days ago. Apparently, that was too limited. Chris Dickman said the original figure, the 480 million, was based on mammals, birds, and reptiles, for which we do have densities. And that figure now is a little bit out of date. It's over 800 million, given the extent of the fires now in New South Wales alone. And so there he's talking about much of the news coverage, at least over the past couple of weeks, has been fires in the New South Wales area. But there are fires burning across Australia, ringing that continent. And while they might have information, greater amount of information in one area, that does not mean that it's not been devastating in other parts as well. He says over a billion would be a very conservative figure. And honestly, because it's animal populations, we very likely will never know how many died. But we know that this is, it's impossible, like that number, you hear a billion, you and I, we have no idea what that means. It is impossible to think of 10,000 koalas, let alone a billion animals. You simply can't picture it. It becomes fiction. It's just a statistic at that point, but a horrific one. Now let's talk about some of the forms it's come in. Critically endangered species, including the southern corroboree frog and the mountain pygmy possum, could be wiped out as fires ravage crucial habitat in Victoria's Alpine National Park in New South Wales neighboring, I'm not gonna try to say that national park. But there, like our previous coverage of what's going on with koalas, you have populations that are not just being devastated, but effectively might be wiped out permanently. Not only because almost all of them might be killed, but because in some cases, the area where they live and breed and feed is being wiped out and won't be able to recover fast enough to save the species. You also have threatened species such as the glossy black cockatoo, the spotted tail quoll, and the long-footed potoro, both small marsupials, are also facing real risks of extinction in large parts of their range. Now, these are generally species that are being wiped out directly by the fires, but there will be animals that will die as almost a secondary effect of the fires, and that includes camels. More than 10,000 camels will be shot by professional shooters in helicopters to prevent them from drinking too much water in drought-afflicted South Australia, with apparently the threat being that they are breaking into people's property to drink water from either from farm areas, from air conditioners, and they've become apparently for those populations a nuisance. But it is, I mean, I can't imagine helicopters flying around and people gunning down literally thousands of camels. Apparently these sorts of cullings are not uncommon in Australia. apparently the population of camels there exceeds 1.2 million. And theoretically, without cullings, that population could double every 8 to 10 years. But on top of the devastation, both to human and animal life that we've seen in Australia over the past few months, the idea that there would be even more voluntary killing is hard to stomach. Okay, that's a little update on what's going on in Australia right now. We're gonna keep an eye on that news as we have over the past few months. But I wanna thank you for joining me. Tomorrow, I'm gonna be joined on the show by Jared Jackson, but also by Congressman Ro Khanna. We're gonna talk about Iran, and you're not gonna wanna miss it. We'll see you then.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.